Good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming. Such a beautiful day. I was really appreciating yesterday, Kate and I arrived, and how beautiful the sky is here. You know, living in Vancouver, I forget that the sky is blue. Although we've had some beautiful days as well recently. Well, I think as some of you know, maybe many of you know, this year we're in the midst of our practice period in Mountain Rain in Vancouver. And our theme is living in samsara, suffering and resilience. Suffering and resilience. And when we communicated with Tim, he mentioned that Sangha, the topic of Sangha, has been quite strong here in Calgary. So Kate and I thought we'd like to talk about suffering and Sangha.
And results.
And resilience, of course. So Sangha, as everyone knows, I think here, is one of the three jewels, right? The Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And these are the qualities that we take refuge in. Traditionally, one becomes officially a Buddhist by taking refuge in the three jewels. So in other words, by publicly saying in one way or another, you know, I take refuge in Buddha, I take refuge in the Dharma, I take refuge in the Sangha. This is part of the Jukai ceremony. When a person receives the precepts, and it's also part of the monthly Fusatsu ceremony, when at some Zen centers we gather together and we chant together the Bodhisattva precepts, usually on the full moon or as close as we can get to the full moon. Kind of reflecting what happened at the time of the Buddha when the monks and nuns would gather together on every full moon and chant to remind everybody about the precepts. The Buddha, an exemplar or guide for us. The Dharma, as the insightful teachings about wisdom and compassion, and the Sangha as the supportive community that helps us as we take up this practice. I think most of us, when we first come to practice, we quickly get the importance and value of the Buddha and the Dharma, right? Kind of a model to follow and the teachings. But the Sangha can kind of seem like an add-on. One Zen teacher I heard referred to the three jewels as actually the two jewels and a rock. Because in today's society, and particularly in the West, the society here is so focused on the individual, on the I, me, and mine of life, that collectively we've become numb to the deep importance and nourishment of community. Not until I lived in Japan as a young man did I really come to understand that our current strong focus on the individual is really only one way to view human life and personal dignity. My friends and acquaintances in Japan showed me, by the way they lived, a larger sense of self, a social self, that while it certainly has its restrictions and boundaries and troubles, also eases that pervasive sense of loneliness and insecurity that's so pervasive here in the West. For the first time, as a young man, I came to see that unlimited personal choice is not freedom. but really a maze of self-doubt and confusion. At that time in Japanese society, there were circles within circles of community, starting with the immediate family, and then the next circle opened to include the extended family, and the next circle opened to include the neighborhood. I remember people out regularly, I think once every week or 2 weeks, collectively picking up garbage, right? And people wear their little neighborhood vest that had their, you know, name of the neighborhood on it, and they're out picking up garbage, men and women, kids. And the next circle may be work or school, and then maybe clubs or group activities, that kind of thing. Kind of circles after circles of self, of community. Each circle offered a sense of self, connection, and security that was not tenuous. And here in Canada, you know, our connections beyond the immediate family, and sometimes even within our immediate family, are rather fragile, and our connections are rather brief. When I first started to practice Zazen with some diligence, and I think what I'm going to say is true for most of us, it was because I was confused and I was suffering. There was a lack or some painful place in my inner life. And although I certainly couldn't articulate it very well, I was impelled to address this pain. And really, don't most of us have a similar reason to begin to practice? Indeed, for all the years I've been doing Dokzan, or kind of private meetings with people, that kind of teacher-student meetings that we're doing, no one has ever said to me, "I'm just so happy and content with my life." So I figured I'd start practicing, since staring at a wall for 30 minutes in silence with others sounds great. For me, the call to practice was bound up, perhaps, with the early death of my father and other events, both small and great. So it was very personal. It was about how to deal with the anguish and confusion of my life. At least that's how I understood it then. It's about Michael. This practice is about Michael. And because I understood it as very personal, the solution would be then to fix myself. After all, isn't that the key message of our culture? I grew up here in Calgary, a cowboy society, a culture that prizes the myth of the individual hero. And so the spoken and deeply unspoken message is that our problems can be fixed with, you know, the right products, plenty of money, enough weekend workshops maybe. So the attitude that many bring, I think, to the Zendo, to this practice, and any other practices that you're doing, is that this nagging problem of my life can be fixed. I just need the right technique. I just need the right teacher. Maybe I need the right guidance, and I can fix this. And then, once I get the right technique and get the right guidance, whatever, then I can go on with my life. Or maybe I can go to my room, my cave, devote myself to meditation until the big light comes on. That's kind of the story, I think, that spoken or unspoken, we kind of carry a little bit, right? But the longer we practice, the more we come to see that this view of practice is really skewed. We need the support of community. We need each other. And I'll go so far to say that without each other, we are lost. The Buddha clearly emphasized the profound importance of companions on this journey. Now, the following is a very famous quote that maybe you've heard before. Ananda, who was the attendant and cousin of the Buddha, spent many years with the Buddha, once walked up to the Buddha and said something about friendship. And this is how the discussion went, at least as it's recorded in the early Pali texts. Ananda said, "Venerable sir, this half of the spiritual life, that's good friendship, good companionship, good comradeship. That's half of the spiritual life." And the Buddha replied, "Do not say this, Ananda. Do not say this. This is the entire spiritual life, Ananda. That is, good friendship, good companionship, and good comradeship. When a monk or nun has a good friend, a good companion, a good comrade, it is to be expected that she or he will develop and cultivate the Noble Eightfold Path." And this passage that emphasizes companionship, Dharma friendship, is not unique in the Buddhist literature. While we can read about, you know, periods of solitude and intense individual practice, the importance of community and friendship is very frequently mentioned in Buddhist texts. The Buddha taught in and was surrounded by Sangha all his teaching life for over 40 years. He never left. And our Zen literature, and there's a lot of Zen literature, for all our touting of, you know, beyond words and that kind of stuff, it's full of encounter dialogues. In other words, short conversations between students and teachers, or between two seasoned practitioners and deep friends. All of it showing us the value of human relationship. In another passage, again in the Pali text, those early texts, the Buddha gives this startling comment on Dharma friendships. He says, "If wanderers who are members of other sects should ask you, 'What friend are the prerequisites for the development of the wings to awakening?' you should answer, 'There is the case where a monk or nun has admirable people as friends, companions, and colleagues. This is the prerequisite for the development of the wings to awakening.'" Isn't that beautiful? And you thought it was some teaching in some book or some teacher somewhere, the right yogic posture. It's your companions. And notice, though, the Buddha clearly says here, admirable people as friends. Well, as we all know, there are friends and then there are friends. Dharma friendship is a particular kind of friendship, a one that nurtures and values integrity. Again, let me give you a quote from the Buddha here. "And how is a person of integrity endowed with the qualities of integrity? There is a case where a person of integrity is endowed with conviction, conscience, concern. She is learned, with aroused persistence, unmuddled mindfulness, and good discernment. This is how a person of integrity is endowed with the qualities of integrity." goes on a little bit more. And how is a person of integrity in his friendship? There's a case where a person of integrity has, as his friends and companions, those priests and contemplatives who are endowed with conviction, conscience, concern, who are learned, and with aroused persistence, unmuddled mindfulness, and good discernment. This is how a person of integrity is a person of integrity in his friendships. Now, this is a little bit written in an old style of English. But as I read this, what stood out for me is a concern, conscience, right? To uphold the precepts, concern for others, that compassion that we cultivate along with wisdom, which is, you know, kind of good discernment. How can I wholesomely live this life with others? So a Dharma friendship today, I think, is partly based on coming together to hear, you know, Dharma talks, meditate, study, attending retreats. That's all true. But it's also based upon a common aspiration, a conviction that we cannot walk this path alone. And we all know that trying to live a life based on a spiritual path is not easy. When we attempt to practice alone, we may frequently be tempted to give up the struggle. It may and probably will at times feel like we're walking through a desert. And without others, we can easily lose our confidence and disparage our own ability. And give in to our desires to have more time to amuse ourselves. Simply spend our time to make more money to buy the latest device. Or more time to have more comfort away from whatever is disturbing us. But when we meet others in Dharma friendship, it really reinforces our own energy and nourishes that part of us that is wholesome. It's like going, you know, on a long hiking trip with a group of friends. We share the load, we talk together, we assist with the tasks, and generally support and help each other. You know, over the years at the Mountain Rain Zen community, there have been quite a few people who I thought had left practice. And then they kind of reappeared, sometimes years later, often saying they felt supported by Sangha even though they couldn't come to the Zendo or to retreats. Kind of amazing, this power of Sangha. So the Sangha is one way we begin to honor life around us. I mean, we become aware and conscious of people beyond our family members and our closest friends. When we take up Zen practice, we commit to making ourselves visible to others. In Zazen and off the cushion, we examine our life without judgment. And in that examination, come to accept our humanness. And something else also starts to happen. As we sit together in silence and talk with each other, we begin to see or make visible the other. As a practitioner, our unspoken commitment is to keep the truth of who we are visible. And as part of the Sangha, the unspoken commitment is to keep the truth of the other visible. To accept the other as part of our collective topography. So Sangha helps us to keep all that we have become aware of in view. And when we get distracted, Sangha can help us return to that wider view of who we are, beyond our little tight stories of failure or inadequacy or greatness. Does anyone hear of a story like, I'm so great? Sometimes that story arises, but for whatever reason in our culture, it's usually the other one. As we all know, this practice of Zazen is beautiful, simple, but not easy. The Buddhist teachings tell us that everything touches everything else. And while there may be moments when we deeply feel this, much of the time we're lost in the busyness and the preoccupation of daily life. And when we come to the Zendo or we come to a retreat, our very being with others encourages us to open beyond the surface fact of things. Sangha helps us to keep before us that which is truer and richer. The word itself, the word Sangha, is a Sanskrit term meaning a gathering or assembly, a collection or a crowd, and hence we use it as a community. In the very early Buddhist texts, it's written that a Sangha is a collection of 10 monks or nuns. That's the official kind of designation way back. But in isolated areas, 5 is okay. Kind of like a quorum, right, in the Jewish tradition. And I've read that in much of Southeast Asia, Sangha still refers mostly to the ordained community and kind of excludes the laity from that term of Sangha. They have another term that they use to include laity. The rationale seems to be that a sympathetic laity is required to support the monks and nuns, but those who are not ordained and living as a monk or nun full-time have rather limited opportunity for realizing both the scholarly and the contemplative goals of Buddhism. However, in the West today, and in many places in East Asia, thinking of Japan and Korea particularly, the understanding of Sangha has evolved to represent the community of all Buddhist followers. It's very expansive. Full-time monastics, ordained but living and working in the world, monastics, lay people, lay men and women, practicing and working, lay people spending time in retreats, lay people coming occasionally to the centers, all arranged kind of like concentric rings of mutual inclusion. This is the meaning of Sangha today. So this understanding of Sangha is vast, including many different streams of Buddhism as well. Perhaps we could say Sangha is the community of those who follow the Buddha's teaching, and really it constitutes one vast worldwide community. Remember the story of Prince Siddhartha. And as a young man, he was motivated to give up the good life and undertake his quest for awakening after he saw the four sights, right, of sickness, old age, death. And the last sight was a wandering shramana, or a wandering ascetic, a monk. A shramana at that time was simply a member of the Indian religious sangha of wandering ascetics. There are many people taking up religious life at that time. And it was this encounter with this particular shramana or monk that was one of the igniting sparks that set the Buddha off, or set Siddhartha off on his journey to become the Buddha. So just as the meeting with the disturbing realities of sickness, old age, and death opened his eyes to the dilemma of human life, the sight of the monk opened his eyes to the possibility of a response to this dilemma. This representative of Sangha did not directly teach Siddhartha anything. His mere presence was sufficient to help awaken Siddhartha in his longing, I should say, for a kind of unbounded life. Throughout history, in the Buddhist tradition, it was understood that Buddhism was established in a new place, not by the presence of an image of the Buddha or by Buddhist books in the library, but by the presence of Sangha. That was the indicator that Buddhism had been established. So as the Buddhist tradition reached Tibet, China, Japan, Korea, great emphasis was always placed on developing Sangha. It was understood that the teachings, practices were great, but the example of the Sangha was needed, and it needed to be passed on from warm hand to warm hand. Teachings were necessary, translation, understanding of the sutras was necessary, and the community of like-minded members was perhaps the most necessary. For without it, the Buddhist tradition would soon die out. So a teacher alone was not enough. A book of Dharma teachings alone, not enough. We need each other. We need Sangha. Sangha is much more than a group of people meeting or hanging out together over some common interest. After taking up this practice, I think we all soon come to admit, at least to some degree, or at least consider the possibility that we cannot and do not practice alone. And this realization is, I think, a radical shift from the independent I mean mine attitude that, as I mentioned earlier, is so often fostered in today's society. In Sangha, we share some common intentions: to be good people, to be aware and mindful, to deepen our intimacy with our own life. But Sangha involves more than common intentions or simply identifying with others. It is a community of action, of doing something with others. And this doing really is the strength of Sangha, because then Sangha becomes a living event. So whether we sit in silence, chant, listen to talks, attend retreats, eat goodies, or sip tea after sitting, in all of these actions, we see a heart of inclusion. In Sangha, we turn toward rather than away from each other. In small and great ways, Sangha teaches the capacity of the heart. And the more we engage with Sangha, the more we receive inspiration, I think, from the basic goodness we encounter around us, from those people around us who are manifesting bravery, compassion, simply in their everyday lives. we meet other people who are also questioning and suffering and committed to cultivating fearlessness and understanding. Life in Sangha is built on shared commitment to go beyond our own self-interest, to go beyond our own personal need. And this is the medicine that we all need. So maybe I made Sangha seem pretty rosy. Now let me point out, Sangha is not rosy. Life, Sangha life, is really far from easy. Because often, the most unlikely people show up in a Sangha. People who, under ordinary circumstances, you would never meet and spend evenings, days, weeks, maybe even years together. As in any gathering of people, there are those who annoy us. Those who we get along easily with, and maybe one or two who will become our deep friends. As you may have already experienced, relationships in Sangha are not perfect. And this has been true from the very beginning of Sangha. The Sangha at the time of the Buddha was not perfect. Quarrels and disputes spread throughout the community at various times, and the Buddha often had to mediate between groups of that formed it within his community to stop their bickering and their complaints of one another. Yet, the container of Sangha was enough for people to take refuge in. Because in the Sangha, there were people who had enough compassion, solidity, and insight to embrace others who did not themselves have much compassion or insight. In Sangha, we come to share something more fundamental than our own interests and our own affinities. And in that sharing, the categories of giver, receiver, and gift no longer hold so much meaning. Sangha is the great teacher, holding up a mirror for each of us to look into. At some point, maybe this has already happened to you, the sort of person you'd avoid at all costs in ordinary life will appear in the Sangha. There he is, or she. And she will be sitting right across from you or beside you in the Zendo. The one who breathes so noisily. The one who forgot their deodorant that day. The one who just can't quite shut up. The one who grabs the biggest cookie all the time. You know the one. You will have to deal with this person in ways you never would have if left to your own devices. Because your first device would be to avoid them altogether, right? So in this way and others, Sangha gives us the opportunity to practice patience and kindness. Because really, you know, after all, a perfect Sangha would not be of much use. We won't learn anything from a perfect Sangha. We'll only learn about ourselves and about others when we rub up against what we have found irritating, annoying in ourselves or in others. So when that person walks in through the door, give a gosh of thanks. Here's my opportunity to deal with, and you can fill in the blank. really, this support we get from each other is mysterious. And it really goes beyond the obvious. The good words we hear, the understanding and sympathy of a heart that's ready to maybe encourage us or exhort us a little bit. It goes beyond all that. I read part of a talk by our teacher, Dzogchen Norman Fisher, in which he describes a conversation going on at another level in the Zendo, a mutual influencing by just being in each other's presence. He was talking about the moments of encounter when we really meet the other with a quiet and open mind. And even if we don't live together in a community, like in a monastery, we still experience moments of encounter because in our sitting and in our practice, we let go. We become softer around the edges. I've read that 60% of our face-to-face communication that we're talking to each other is actually nonverbal, body language. And perhaps in our silent sitting, our bows and chanting, we become more open, more intimate, able to receive and deeply meet the other. In this way, the other becomes less and less other. When I look back over my life as a Dharma practitioner, I see that I have always been supported and encouraged by the Sangha, by the Dharma friendships that have formed over the years. And sometimes these friends, through their words and actions, have helped me, and I am deeply grateful. Mostly, however, it has been the shared convictions, however muddled or unspoken, the moments of encounter that have sustained me over the last 35 years or so. In the end, I don't really have a good definition of what Sangha is. Because it's not like joining a club or a gym, getting a card to carry around in your wallet. You guys don't have a card, do you? But it is there. When our life is dry or bitter, when our life is traveling at 100 miles or so an hour, Sangha is there. We all need to nourish and maintain Sangha, whatever it means to you. You need to nourish that for yourself, for those around you, and for those yet to come. A warm hand to warm hand. From the time of the Buddha till today, that has been the great gift of Sangha. For this retreat and after, please bring to mind this commitment, however you understand Sangha, whether it's this particular community, larger world. Remember those yet to come. They need your warm hand. open, extended. They need to know, no matter how broken they feel, the hand is there. Thank you.
Goes with the first and third verses on page 4.